What if I told you that a single decision you make about your federal student loans in the next few months could cost you or save you more than $100,000 over the course of your career? Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you would learn in medical school. I'm your host, Dr. Jimmy Turner. For this episode, who recently spent an entire Saturday morning reading Federal Register documents over 134 pages long on student loan rules so that you don't have to. So this is another solo episode. Justin will be back on the next show. But for this one, I wanted to fly solo because what we're going to talk about today is genuinely one of the biggest changes to the physician student loan space that I've seen in my entire career. And I wanted to walk through it carefully in my own words without splitting the runtime with Justin and bothering him because he doesn't always love getting into the weeds on student loans. In fact, it's something that he likes to ignore because it's gotten so complicated. That said, I don't want to leave you out there without knowing this information as a listener to Money Meets Medicine. So some quick context for new listeners. This show is usually co-hosted by me and my buddy Justin Harvey, a fee-only financial planner at APM Wealth. And we do a lot of co-hosted shows, occasionally do some interviews, and every once in a while, there's a specific topic I'll go solo on like this one. And the topic today demands that kind of attention because on May 1st, 2026, or earlier this month as the show goes live, the Department of Education dropped the final rule implementing the student loan provisions of what was originally called the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which, by the way, has been officially renamed the Working Families Tax Cuts Act. I'm not sure if that's better or worse, less beautiful maybe, but because apparently that pulled better, same law, new name, that final rule is 134 pages of dense regulatory text in the Federal Register. And I read the whole thing. I had Claude read the whole thing. Because the moment that the final rule came out, I knew that there were going to be a lot of things physicians in training making decisions needed to know about to avoid six-figure mistakes over the next several months based on whatever that guidance was going to show for us. And a lot of what is floating around out on the internet is incomplete or inaccurate or out of date. So today I want to walk through in plain English what actually changed, who's affected, what the playbook looks like for current residents pursuing public service loan forgiveness, and the traps, and there are several, to be honest, that can permanently lock you out of certain options, and it's a huge deal, a big mistake. Heads up, this is going to be a little technical. I know we like to take things big picture, keep them big picture on Money Meets Medicine a lot of the time, but I'm going to cite some specific sections in the regulation and specific ideas from it. I will leave some descriptions in the show notes for you if you want to check that out, take notes, listen to this episode twice or both. And as always, the standard disclaimer applies. I'm a practicing anesthesiologist and a podcaster. I'm a financial literacy expert. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not your advisor. And this regulatory landscape changes constantly, and it's still evolving at the servicer level. So yes, you probably need to talk to your servicer. No, they're not always helpful. Yes, that is not as good as it should be, but is the situation. So if your situation is at all complicated, you're married, dual physician household, working spouse with their own loans, mid-residency consolidation question, anything like that, you probably still need to get a student loan consult to learn more about the one I recommend. In terms of the company that can help you there, moneymeetsmedicine.com/loans is where you should go. But I want to dive into this. And before we do, it's that time of year. It is literally Disability Insurance Awareness Month. So longtime listeners know that I believe in disability insurance, the number one financial task for doctors, because no income, your lifestyle stops, investing stops, paying down student loans, we're going to talk about in this episode, stops. And we are in that period of the academic year where it's fundamentally important to remind you that you cannot leave residency or fellowship without getting disability insurance. At Money Meets Medicine Disability Insurance, we have the lowest denial rate that I am aware of in the industry, period. The average is usually around 20%. And at Money Meets Medicine, our denial rate is literally less than 1%. We've never had a resident who has access to a GSI, a guaranteed policy, get denied, ever. And as of recent changes, maybe a podcast for a different day, every resident in the country now has an access to a GSI available to you. So if you've been listening to this for a while and maybe you've reached out in the past and you didn't have one, things changed literally in the last 2 weeks as I'm recording this. So if you're looking for a place that you can trust to get disability insurance, to get quotes, please choose us at Money Meets Medicine Disability. We'd be honored to help take care of you. You can do that by visiting moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability. Click the get a quote button, fill out the intake form, and my partner, Michael Kittner, will be in touch shortly after you fill that out. All right, so let's get into this. Here is what I want to cover on the episode. We're going to talk about a 30,000 foot view first. We're going to talk about RAP, the repayment assistance plan, and the income-based repayment plans in this RAP to IBR playbook, I'll call it. We're going to also talk about things you can do to permanently destroy your IBR option. Definitely something to listen out to avoid, to be aware of. And we'll talk about some other things as well, including filing taxes separately, how that impacts things. Before we do, let's just get really big picture, right? Private loans, federal loans, those are the two types of loans you can have for med school, right? Private loans are not hard. You basically want to refinance these things to the lowest interest rate you can afford at a payment you can afford while you're in training. And you want to keep refinancing because unlike a mortgage, refinancing student loans doesn't come with any fees. That said, you almost never want to refinance your federal student loans while you're in training. This is just a private loan thing. But if you are looking for the place to find the lowest interest rate out there for student loan refinancing, go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/Juno. That's J-U-N-O, Juno, to check out, you guessed, Juno. They provide the lowest rates that I've personally seen. And in fact, they offer you a match. So if you find a lower rate than what they can provide you, they will match it. So that link is moneymeetsmedicine.com/Juno, J-U-N-O. Federal loans, that's the other pot of things we're talking about here. It is a trickier situation. So that's what this new update is about. 30,000 foot view. What just happened is on May 1st, 2026, the Department of Education published the final ruling on this Family Tax Cuts Act, formerly OBA. And that rule takes effect July 1st of 2026. So this was passed originally, the OBA law, One Big Beautiful Bill Act, 119-21, July 4th of 2025. But then we've been waiting for some time to really have some clarity about how this is going to impact student loans, because the headline change that we saw is that there's going to be this two-plan world where there are many programs like Pay As You Earn and Save and ICR that were just going to be completely done away with, and you were going to be left with your repayment assistance plan and income-based repayment. There's also something in there called the tier standard repayment plan. We're not going to talk about that too much today, but what we took from that is that, okay, ICR is gone, Pay As You Earn is gone, Repay and Save are gone. And in fact, if you're in Pay As You Earn, you apparently have to decide whether you want to be in RAP or IBR by July of 2028, because that's what's in this new update. Why this matters right now is that if you're a current resident fellow, you're an MS4 becoming an intern with federal student loans, you have decisions to make over the next few months that will impact the next potentially 10 or 20 years of your payment life, depending on what your situation is. So some important dates to keep in mind, July 1st, 2026, this is the day the rule took effect. This is also the date that determines your eligibility for income-based repayment. So if you have loans and they all date back before July 1st of 2026, you are eligible for income-based repayment. I'm not going to get into the weeds on new versus old IBR, but let's just say July 1st, 2026 is the cutoff. Why does this matter? This is one of those bridges I'm going to emphasize a couple times on the show. You can't burn. Okay. So a lot of us for years have told students to consolidate their student loans so that you can skip the grace period your intern year and start getting those low monthly payments to count towards public service loan forgiveness. Guess what? If you consolidate your student loans and that consolidation loan where you take all of those different federal direct loans and that are out there and you combine them into one single loan, that's a consolidation process. And that new consolidation loan disperses after July 1st of 2026, you are now no longer eligible for income-based repayment and only eligible for the repayment assistance plan, or RAP. That's what we'll call it for the rest of the episode. And so that RAP plan is great for lots of reasons we're about to talk about. But for many of you listening, you want to keep your IBR eligibility intact so that you can switch into it later. I'm foreshadowing a bit here about one of the big changes that just came out and the reason that I'm making this entire episode right now. But suffice it to say, consolidation, you need to think very thoughtfully about this because it often will take 4 to 6 weeks. I'm publishing this episode at the end of May, actually the beginning of June, as this comes out, I'm recording at the end of May. And so there's a chance that if you try to consolidate your loans, even before you start intern year, for example, or you're in residency and considering doing that, that you're going to need IBR later and no longer be eligible because your consolidation loan got spit out after July 1st of 2026. So that's really important to understand. July 1st, 2028 is the other deadline that's talked about a lot in this Federal Register. It's the absolute deadline for current Pay As You Earn, Repay, Save, and ICR borrowers to elect a new plan. I'm not going to go into big detail on that for this, but suffice it to say that this is really important, okay? Bottom line, for residents starting July 2026 intern year, you're almost certainly had your last medical school loan disperse in spring of 2026 before that July 1 cutoff. That means you are in the privileged last class to be eligible for income-based repayment. We don't know exactly if you're listening to this as a first, second, or third year med student, if you can have the same rules for all those loans that were before July 1st, 2026 and have different rules for the loans that are after that. Once we have clarity on that, I'll bring it back up on the show in the future. But the rest of this episode is largely about how to use that privilege intelligently for those of you that are income-based repayment eligible while you're still in residency. So we're going to call this the wrap to IBR playbook for current residents. And the basic strategy in one sentence is that if you graduated medical school in May of 2026 or before, so your loans are pre-July 1st, 2026, the repayment assistance plan wrap during training makes sense for a lot of residents. In fact, I would argue it makes sense for almost every resident who's filing taxes single, so you're a single resident. And it still makes sense for a lot of residents who are married, and we'll talk about why. But wrap during training has two features that no other plan has. The first is an interest subsidy. Okay, it's $50 a month. Don't really care, to be honest with you, about the interest subsidy is the part you do care about. You also get a $50 monthly matching principal payment. So that part technically reduces your loans, but the interest subsidy is the most important part. That interest subsidy in wrap, after you make your monthly payments, any interest that's not covered, instead of accruing on your loans like it would in income-based repayments, the government waives it. It basically goes away. It's forgiven. It's gone. So said differently, your balance never grows during residency due to that unpaid interest being waived while you're in wrap. That is massive. So let's say that you start residency with $300,000 in student loans and you enroll in wrap because you're a single resident and you stay in wrap for a five-year general surgery residency. Instead of watching that $300,000 turn into what would normally become about $450,000 by the end of those 5 years, you will have $300,000. Your loan balance will not have increased. And this is really important because when you're in your first year of residency, you don't know if you're going to be going into public service loan forgiveness or not. You don't know if you're going into an academic job or you're going to get a job at the VA or some state hospital. You really just don't know. And before this ruling came out, we all thought, unfortunately, you're going to have to decide between IBR and wrap in your first 6 months out of training or out of medical school and just hope that you got it right and you'd be permanently stuck in one plan or the other. But now that we know that you can actually switch plans, we'll get to that in a second, that's not the case. This is a really powerful thing. This interest subsidy is a really big deal. You make your $10 payments based on your $0 income because you filed taxes as a fourth year med student. If you haven't, do that. And so your payment's gonna be 10 bucks in wrap. And your $300,000 that should be growing at 7% interest for the next 5 years, accruing $1,600 a month in interest, by the way, that's the math, won't accrue any. At the end of your 5 years, you'll owe slightly less technically than $300,000. That is a huge deal. So that's why a lot of you want to consider wrap at the beginning of training or during training if you're in the middle of residency, and why you might consider enrolling in that when it becomes available. Now, the wrap to IBR play comes into effect at the end of training. So let's talk about that. If you are in wrap, and let's say you have $150,000 student loans, and you're going to be an anesthesiologist making $500,000 a year. My friend, when your debt-to-income ratio is that good, you're just going to pay off your student loans. So you're going to be in wrap during training. When you finish, you're going to want to refinance that debt to the lowest rate you can get, which moneymeetsmedicine.com/Juno, if you want to get the lowest rates that are out there that I've seen. And you are going to now then pay off that debt aggressively. So you're in the aggressive payoff group. So you're going to be in wrap during training. And when you finish training, you're going to refinance because now you're going to be paying the full interest on that once your payments go up, when your income does. And instead, you're going to refinance to a lower interest rate and hammer away at that debt and get it gone, right? Before we get back to it, let's talk taxes. As many of you know, I recently took a 1099 private practice gig as an anesthesiologist after being a W-2 doc for 15 years. And honestly, after combining this with the business income from Money Meets Medicine, the tax piece almost broke me. Should I be an S-Corp? What about QBI deductions or the pass-through entity tax breaks I should be taking advantage of? Nobody really teaches this stuff in residency. You just kind of figure it out after you've already screwed it up. That's why I started working with Gelt for proactive tax planning for my own taxes. Gelt is a modern CPA firm that specializes in helping high-earning physicians. So whether you're a locums doc, a practice owner, a partner getting a K-1, or a W-2 physician with 1099 income on the side, Gelt handles the stuff that actually moves the needle. S-Corp elections, PTET credits, QBI, retirement optimization, really everything in between. The biggest reason I started working with Gelt myself is that unlike most CPA firms, they provide a proactive strategy all year long, not just an intake form and running the numbers in February or March each year. So if your CPA only reached out in February or March and left you wondering if you paid more on taxes than you should, it doesn't have to be that way. A great CPA is a year-round partner who knows your business and reaches out proactively. And Q2 is the best time to make a switch because Gelt specializes in exactly this kind of transition for those of you who are ready for a better experience. Speaking of which, when new clients get started this quarter, Gelt goes back through your last 3 years of returns and identifies deductions that were missed, and in some cases is able to recover them. This is included as a complimentary service for new clients. So if your tax situation has outgrown TurboTax or your current CPA only calls you in March each year, head over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA for a free consult with Gelt. And because you're a part of the Money Meets Medicine community, when you use that link, you'll also get a 10% discount off services with Gelt that first year as well. So head on over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA and check out Gelt. The second group is the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Group. This is where income-based repayment comes back in because IBR is more attractive for high-earning attendings, potentially, than RAP for two reasons. One is because of the way that the calculation works. Your monthly payments were technically going to be lower in IBR than they would be in RAP. Now, if you don't want your student loan burden to increase during training, you don't care. And honestly, when you're in residency, the payments are so low in both of these plans that they're affordable for residents, and you're not going to choose to be in IBR just for a lower monthly payment than RAP if you don't know that you're doing public service loan forgiveness, right? Because who cares if you're saving 50 or 100 bucks a month if your debt's going to increase by 150% during training? RAP is going to prevent that, right? The reason that you do care about IBR is because IBR has something called the standard repayment cap. IBR payment caps at what you would have to pay if you paid it off yourself in a 10-year standard repayment plan. So if you took your $300,000, they would calculate, okay, you owe X number of dollars per month to pay this off in 10 years by yourself with this interest rate. Whatever that payment is, in IBR, once you get to that payment based on your income calculation, you can make $1 million a year. Let's say it's 10% of $1 million. You owe 100 grand a year. So you're paying close to $10,000 a month, $8,000 per month towards your student loans. But guess what? Your student loan repayment plan calculation says that you only need to pay $2,500 a month to pay off that $300,000 in that timeline. Guess what? Now you don't owe $8,000 a month like you would in RAP, for example. The repayment assistance plan has no cap. That is the big difference here. The IBR plan would say, nope, you hit our cap, $2,500 a month. That's the most you can pay. You stay in that until you make your 120 payments in public service loan forgiveness, and now your debt is forgiven. And so that person who stayed in RAP until they knew whether they were going to do PSLF or not, fantastic. They then switched to IBR prior to those payments skyrocketing in RAP when you have now verified your attending income and you're going to be paying 10% of that number no matter how large it gets. Because remember, RAP does not have a cap. IBR does. That's when you'd want to switch to IBR if you're planning to do public service loan forgiveness. So this RAP to IBR playbook is really helpful for a lot of you. Now, you need to look at your individual situation to really determine if that's the right thing for you or not. But for direct loans made before July 1st of 2026, this is the legal language that tells us people can switch plans. Okay, because this was the big question and the reason that this episode is actually being produced is this one line from this register document on the federal ruling for student loans. It says, and I quote, for direct loans made before July 1st, 2026, because remember, it's got to be before then to qualify for IBR, a borrower who has entered repayment may change to any other repayment plan for which this borrower is eligible at any time by notifying the secretary. At any time means any time. There is no deadline. So a lot of us thought before that you had to switch into IBR before July 1st of 2028. This ruling left that date out. You can do RAP for residency and switch into IBR later based on the way that this ruling is worded. And so even if July 1st, 2028 did somehow magically pop back up and become this date, you'd have 2 years to be in RAP now, and you'd have 2 years to watch people be able to switch between plans to know that, in fact, this ruling that is written down in law is accurate. But it says you may enter repayment, may change to any other repayment plan for which the borrower is eligible at any time by notifying the secretary. This is really important. Okay. Now, some of you are going to read this and you're going to see the headlines and you get misinformation here because one of the questions I've been getting is, hey, Jimmy, that's great, but the RAP payments don't count towards public service loan forgiveness, right? So why would I do that? Because then I'm missing out on all those payments towards IBR. That's actually not true. RAP payments do count towards public service loan forgiveness. RAP payments do not count towards income-based repayment forgiveness. So if you are in the situation, this is true for some people, it's rare for doctors, although it does exist. So if you are, for example, a pediatrician and you're going to make a couple hundred thousand dollars a year and you have $1 million in student loans, but you're not going to be working for a PSLF qualifying employer, which, by the way, if you're in that situation, you should absolutely unequivocally be doing everything you can to work for a PSLF qualifying employer. But let's say for whatever reason, life reasons, career reasons, you just can't do that. You would be wanting to go for what's called income-driven repayment forgiveness. These are forgiveness programs that are built into the IDR plan itself. So IBR has forgiveness that happens at 20 years. Now it's taxable, That's a big tax bomb. Paying taxes on over $1 million in student loan forgiveness would be quite the large tax bill. But there are some people where they are trying to get forgiveness through income-driven repayment programs themselves and not through public service loan forgiveness. RAP payments do not count towards the income-driven repayment forgiveness. RAP payments do count towards public service loan forgiveness. So you can absolutely be in RAP, make 48 payments in RAP, and then switch to IBR. And now in IBR, your first payment's going to be the 49th payment. You pay till 120 payments, and now you get tax-free forgiveness of your student loans by making 120 qualifying PSLF payments while working at a qualifying employer. This matters because if you're confident you're going to land at and stay at a PSLF qualifying employer for 10 years, RAP, then IBR still wins. But if there's real uncertainty about whether you're going to be working at a PSLF qualifying employer and your debt to income ratio is so bad that there's a chance you're going to be doing income-driven repayment forgiveness, which again is rare for physicians, but it does exist, then those payments in RAP are not going to count towards that long-term 20-year forgiveness in IBR. You would be starting the clock as an attending if you switch into IBR then. I mention this because it is a caveat, it's an exception, but for the overwhelming majority of you listening, if you go for forgiveness, you're going to be doing the PSLF variety of forgiveness, and RAP payments do count towards that. So, important to mention, most residents are going to be in RAP, and then you're going to either aggressively pay it off and refinance when you finish, finding the lowest interest rate you can find, or you're going to go to a public service loan forgiveness qualifying employer, make the rest of your 120 qualifying payments, potentially switch to IBR if you hit the cap and get your loans forgiven. So there are two traps that can permanently destroy your IBR option. All right. So we've mentioned one, which is the consolidation trap. This is definitely the bigger one and more dangerous. It's the one that I want every single physician listening to this show to internalize, to share with friends. When you consolidate your existing federal loans into a direct consolidation loan, that consolidation loan itself is a new direct loan. And if it gets dispersed after July 1st of 2026, you are now ineligible for income-based repayment. And so let's say that you're in RAP and you want to do public service loan forgiveness and you are a neurosurgeon making $1 million a year. Guess what, my friend? RAP's payments, as soon as you go above $100,000 a year, it's 10% of your income. So you're basically paying $100,000 per year towards your student loans. And so that becomes very expensive. There's no cap in RAP. That rhymes. That's like Cat in the Hat, right? And so it's a really catastrophic mistake to consolidate your loans, get that new loan dispersed, need income-based repayment later, and then to find out, guess what? You're not eligible because of that consolidation loan. So consolidation is the trickiest part of this whole thing, in my opinion. And one reason why, if you're mid-residency and considering consolidation, that is a student loan consult automatically for me. But there's another one, which is this split vintage trap that I alluded to earlier. So the May 2027 grad problem, for example, you have some direct loans that are before July 1st, 2026, and you have some direct loans that are after that because your fourth year med student was after July 1st of 2026. This is problematic. I don't know what the answer to this is in practice yet, because the way that the ruling is written, it makes it sound like you could treat some of those loans, all the loans before July 1st of 2026 separately. It doesn't base it on the borrower level. Based on what I've read, it doesn't say that anyone who is a borrower who has taken loans out after July 1st of 2026 is ineligible for income-based repayment. The way that I read it, and we'll see as clarity comes about this, and I'll continue to update the podcast as it does, is that any loans taken out after July 1st, 2026 do not qualify. Any loans taken out before do. So if you read it that way, then you could read this as being individual loan level, and you could have your loans, in fact, qualify for the RAP to IBR playbook for those loans that you took out in those first 3 years of med school. So if you have any way to fund your MS 4 year without taking on new federal loans, obviously that's the best way to deal with this problem. And for all of us normal humans that don't have that ability, if you're taking on loans, you're probably taking on federal loans. I would just play this one by ear. Just keep your ear to the ground, stay abreast of student loan information so that you can determine if this is an individual loan thing that you can be very thoughtful about in terms of handling pre-July 1st, 2026 loans one way and the post-July 1st, 2026 loans a different way. Some other things I wanted to mention on the show are that the death of resident-friendly deferments. So this has not really been a thing for a while now, but general forbearance is now capped at 9 months in a 24-month period for new borrowers. Before, if you knew nothing about student loans like I did, you would forbear on your student loans every 12 months and it would just kick the can down the road, which is very tempting for a busy resident trying to learn how to be a doctor and just manage life in the midst of all that. Student loans are the last thing you really want to be dealing with. And that's exactly what I did because I didn't know anything about student loans back then. Now, because of their payment assistance plan and that amazing interest subsidy and some of the other options you now have available, forbearance is a last ditch, absolute financial catastrophe kind of emergency. You would never want to do forbearance for pretty much any reason unless you had an absolute financial emergency. But they are limiting how long you can take for forbearance in this plan, which is important to mention. You can't just kick the can down the road 12 months. Now, RAF's interest subsidy, again, is so great that I'd be willing to take that if I was a resident as a substitute, because your intern year payments, if you're a single resident, are going to be based on MS4 income. So that's $10 a month. That's very affordable, obviously. Your PGY2 payments are going to be from, think about that tax year. Half that tax year is still going to be from you being a medical student, and half of it's going to be from you being an intern. So now you're paying 3 to 4% of $35,000, which again leads to a very reasonable monthly payment. It's only your PGY3 year when you start to get up to a higher monthly payment in RAP that is a little less affordable. But if you've got this plan in place and you're getting this interest subsidy that keeps your debt from increasing, I think it's totally worth it. But it's really important to realize that forbearance and kicking the can down the road has changed a little bit. I don't recommend that for anybody anyway, unless there's a financial emergency. And another thing I want to talk about is RAP mechanics. I'm not going to go through all of the details of this because it's just a podcast is not the right form for this. You can read about it if you want. But essentially, the payment goes from $10, which is the minimum, up to increases basically 1% for every $10,000 in income that you have until you get to $100,000. And then it's 10% of your full adjusted gross income with no cap. So $10 minimum as an intern. And then when you get to that $70,000 bracket, you're going to be paying 7% of that. So $4,900 a year. If my back of the napkin public math is right, if it's wrong, sorry. That said, the payments are very reasonable, particularly that first and second year while you are in training. And at the bare minimum, you've now had 2 years to make a decision about what your post-residency life is going to look like. If you plan to aggressively paying it off, again, staying in RAP doesn't let your debt burden increase. It's probably worth it, but your balance does not grow because of that unpaid interest being waived, right? That said, the RAP payment works differently. It's not just 10% of your income like it is an IBR. It is 1% if you make 10 to 20, 2% if you make 20 to 30. It's graded as you go up. Another thing to mention, just because I know I'm gonna get this question, so I'm just gonna go ahead and head it off before I get a bunch of emails, is that yes, you can still file your taxes separately in the repayment assistance plan, just like you can in IBR. And this is important because the married question, some of you have been listening to this episode for a little bit, and you're like, great, Jimmy, you keep talking about single residents. You can file your taxes separately in the repayment assistance plan as well. And so if you have a very high income earning spouse, maybe they're an attending physician and you're still in residency, you could file your taxes separately and you're not going to take a 10% hit on their income too. And that's really important because this may keep your RAP plans available and your student loan debt burden from increasing without having to owe a bunch of money on it. Alternatively, if you're planning on paying it off yourself and you do have a spouse with a very high income, you could refinance and just start paying off your debt. The not so good news, RAP does change the math a little bit. So under IBR, marrying filed separately lets you pay 10% of your discretionary income only. Under RAP, the married filing separately lets you pay a percentage of basically your full AGI. So it is still slightly higher than the IBR percentage if you file separately. And ultimately, when you're asking this question about whether to file separately or not, it is not student loans in a vacuum. It is the married filing separately tax penalty is the way I like to think about this. When you file your taxes separately, your tax bill often goes up. And so you are asking the question, is the student loan payment amount that I'm saving more than what my tax bill would go up? And if the answer is yes, then filing separately can make sense. But let's say that you are saving $5,000 on your student loan payments, but your tax bill goes up by $10,000. That's a net loss of $5,000. You should probably just file jointly in that plan. This is important to mention because there are community property states like California, Texas, Arizona, a few others where the math works differently than, let's say, where I live, where if you file separately, it completely excludes your spouse's income. So the calculations there for filing separately get into nuance. They are different. Again, this is a student loan consult kind of situation potentially, but you should know that you can file separately in the repayment assistance plan, just like you can in IBR. So run the numbers if you're married, and determine how much your tax burden will increase if you file separately, and look at your student loan payments and determine how much am I going to save on my student loan payments in order to keep my student loan burden from increasing if I'm in RAP. And does that make sense? Is that penalty worth it to be in RAP and file separately? And if not, you might file jointly. That said, strong recommendation to not make this analysis or decision by back of the napkin math. you should probably involve a student loan consult. You can go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/loans to learn more about how to get a consult if that is something that you're interested in, and make sure that you do the right thing, obviously. So this is a really important episode, and I know this is into the weeds. I know this is detail-oriented. It's a 30-minute episode on student loans, but it's so important. This is such a fundamentally important episode for so many of you listening. So please share this with friends. And as we wrap up, let me just remind you of things. Number one, figure out what your loan situation is July 1st, 2026, before or after. That will make you income-based repayment eligible or not. If you're an intern starting in July 2026, be very careful about consolidating. That is very common advice, and it used to be good advice, but now it's outdated, potentially. And if you hear this in July, it's definitely outdated. If you want to keep IBR intact, you cannot consolidate your student loans. The second you do that and your new loan disperses after July 1st of 2026, you're now ineligible for IBR, which I guess I should mention, there are some of you that have submitted a consolidation application before, maybe in May or in June as you're listening to this. You need to keep an eye on that and make sure that it's not going to disperse after July 1st, 2026. And if it looks like it's going to, you need to cancel your consolidation or consider doing so. I guess I can't advise you because your situation is individual and unique, but I would consider canceling that and keeping an eye on it so that, great, if you consolidate beforehand and get into the repayment assistance plan and do everything we just talked about before July 1st, 2026, fantastic. I am not super trustful that the government can move that efficiently, but if that's not the case, fantastic, good for you. But keep your eye on the date, keep your eye on the clock, on the calendar, so that you can cancel that application if you should need to. Number three, if you have private student loans, you obviously need to just refinance those to the lowest possible interest rate you can possibly manage at a monthly payment that's affordable in residency. To look at the best rates, go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/Juno, J-U-N-O, and they can walk you through the process of figuring out how to do that. And they even have a match. If you find a better rate, they will match it. Four, if you're a current MS3 graduating May 2027, you're going to have to figure out where your loans fall and just keep your ear to the ground in terms of which loans will apply or if it's at the borrower level, which is not the way that I read it, but we haven't seen anything go through yet. And it's often helpful to see case studies of things as they're actually dealt with. And lastly, if any of this feels overwhelming, you can always get a consult or a coaching session, moneymeetsmedicine.com/loans, and make sure that you stay abreast of this information. It's super important and really can lead to large 5- and 6-figure mistakes if you get this wrong. And I probably should have mentioned this at the front of the show, but I'll mention it here. If you privately refinance your federal loans, public service loan forgiveness is gone forever. So anytime I do a student loan episode, I always like to mention that because private refinancing for private loans is a fantastic thing. Private loans that you refinance from federal loans that could have been in the repayment assistance plan and not accruing basically any interest, almost always a bad idea. I can't say always because there's always an exception, but the overwhelming majority of the time, that is not a great idea. Keep your federal loans federal, refinance your private loans until you finish training. And then once you decide you're in the aggressive payoff group, that's when you refinance those federal loans. All right, everybody. So that's the show. If you got value out of this episode, do me a favor, share it with a resident, fellow, attending, medical student who needs this information. They have student loans. This is one of the windows in time where forwarding this 30-minute episode to a friend can genuinely save them 6 figures over their career. Don't underestimate that. This episode is airing at the end of the academic year. So please, as you head out, don't forget, get your disability insurance done. Moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability. Get a quote from us. We'll make sure that you have access to all of the things that you need, including any guaranteed standard issue plans that are available to you, and get you quotes on that. We have the lowest denial rate in the history. So if you're looking for somebody to trust, look no further. Money Meets Medicine Disability Insurance is the place to go. Have questions, comments, concerns, hit me up at jimmy@moneymeetsmedicine.com and look forward to hearing from you. As always, thank you for being here. Thanks for sharing the show with friends. Thank you for being part of the Money Meets Medicine community. Cheers.
Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.